today on Ag News Daily.
It's what the weather does going forward as to what the risk is going to be for our corn for pretty much any of the foliar diseases. And so as I think about the risk for something like tar spot or any other foliar disease, I'm thinking about how susceptible my hybrid is to that, or in soybeans' case, how susceptible my variety might be to something like frog eye leaf spot.
Well, welcome back to the weekly edition of the Ag News Daily Show. We've got Delaney sitting in here with us, but a different Delaney.
For sure.
Welcome. We did have flooding in Northwest Iowa. We broke records over the weekend after storms dropped 10 inches of rain and up to 15 inches in some areas. Across parts of Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa, homes and farms are underwater along multiple rivers, including the Little Sioux, the Big Sioux, and the Rock. Governor Reynolds said a sudden surge of water drove the rivers to levels surpassing the flood of 1993, which has long been the high water mark for the state. According to Reynolds, 250 people were saved in water rescues in Northwest Iowa. More than 1,000 flood victims stayed in community shelters, and at least 1,900 properties have been flooded, with that number continuing to rise. That's based on early estimates, in addition to large areas of farmland being affected. Governor Kim Reynolds has expanded her state disaster proclamation for flooding in western Iowa to include five more counties now on the Missouri River, where water levels are still rising, with an addition of Fremont, Mills, Pottawatomie, Harrison, and Monona County. The disaster proclamation now covers 27 county area. The Army Corps of Engineers officials are not expecting major flooding along the Missouri, but levee systems along the river's banks are what is under watch, Delaney.
It's crazy out there.
A ton of water. Those pictures have been devastating to see.
They really have. Corn and soybean conditions fell over the past week following a wide mix of weather in the Midwest and Plains, including heavy rainfall, like we talked about, and flooding in some of those northern areas, and mostly hot and dry weather to the south and east. The USDA says 69% of corn is rated good to excellent, with 97% emerged and 4% silking, both ahead of the five-year averages. 67% of soybeans are rated good to excellent, with 97% planted and 90% emerged, with 8% blooming, all faster than the average. 52% of U.S. winter wheat is rated good to excellent conditions, with 40% harvest, and 71% of spring wheat is reported as good to excellent, with 18% of crop headed.
You know, I don't think we need the old Delaney anymore. You did a good job on your first news story. But now it's time to jump into our Red Star agronomic update for the week. So here we go. Here we are. You guys know what time it is, listeners. It's Red Star Daily Update. It is time for us to jump into our relationship here with the Red Star folks and learn about what advantages we can provide you during this growing season. We're here to talk about the timing of fungicide applications with the folks from Red Star. Again, just to remind you, you got Brody, Ryan, and Tom here. Brody, let's start off with, why is it important to pay attention to when you apply a fungicide?
Yeah, so two purposes that we typically see around fungicide. Obviously, a fungicide's there is to keep the plant healthy from a fungicidal standpoint. So if we have any sort of disease, we want the fungicide there to be able to get us through the reproductive stages when that plant is focused on reproducing and not really protecting itself as much. The other thing is just from a general plant health standpoint and what it does to help lower stress, and we visually can see those health benefits. But from a physiological standpoint, you know, your plant goes through a natural curve of transpiration, and it transpiration is no more than water being pulled through the plant so it can pull nutrients to it. And so through the vegetative time frames, that plant wants to pull as much water as it can through it so it can pull as much nutrients as it can through mass flow to be able to create sugars, create carbohydrates, and produce the energy that then can be translocated into its offspring or into the ear then during reproduction. And so when we look at the timing and that natural curve, once we tassel, transpiration naturally drops. And so that's the key time frame of a physiological standpoint, that we're not disrupting the transpiration process and our nutrient carbohydrate creation or carbohydrate creation. And we can help protect the plant the most at that time frame as well.
And that's where nitrogen becomes such a huge part of it, right? Because the nitrogen is what's going to be responsible for us making those starches and proteins, and it's going to drive really ear feel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we've got to watch the weather a little bit. And that's why we do so many things with the demand curves, is we can pretty well dial in to what Dr. Fred Bielow's done over the years and say, we need to make sure that we have what we need when we need it. And the big concern I have right now is nitrogen because of all the moisture we've had. And one of the things that we developed specifically for the 2024 use season is a new product called Finish Line. And it was developed from the standpoint of when you get to VT and R1, that plant would prefer to have ammonium nitrogen because it takes it in right now and it uses it and processes it. Most of the time, because of our soil temperatures, the minute you put anything nitrogen in the soil, it's converting from ammonium to nitrate in a period of 48 hours. So what we've done is developed a product that is ammonium, and we've protected it. So when you put it on, either Y drop or through fertigation, and it hits that soil, it's going to stay in the ammonium form for 2 to 3 weeks, which means that plant is going to readily suck it up and utilize it. Doesn't have to expend any energy to strip off the oxygen from nitrate and add hydrogen. It's in that NH4 form. And so the plant can just use it right now. We should call it right now nitrogen is what we should do. But we look at that as critical. So if you're, you know, if you're in parts of the Midwest that don't have irrigation, but you're Y dropping, Finish Line's an excellent product. If you're out in the Western Corn Belt, Nebraska, the Dakotas, Kansas, where there's a lot of irrigation, it's our preferred product as we go through the pivot to make sure that it gets to that crop, gets utilized. And the big thing, protect it from leaching, prevent it from, you know, volatilization off the soil surface. So that's one that we're excited about.
Then we also have sulfur in there in the sulfate form and some potash. So it's a complete product and it's red, so it fits us.
So we've talked about the Y drop method through our irrigation, whether it's through pivot or drip, whichever it is. But Ryan, what other ways do your customers apply their fungicides?
So we can also help you out with a drone application if you're in the Midwest. We partnered with TerraPlex. So if you're in Iowa, Minnesota, we can help you out there. If you're in Nebraska, we can help you out with drones or Rogator type stuff or planes. So yeah, we have all sorts of different options.
On top of that, with the drone application, you know, we hit on the fertigation, hit on the Y drop, but you know, you look at Iowa, you look at Illinois, there's not as much of that going on. And so what is another way that we can get amino acids and proteins into the plant, but also add another level of stress mitigation to that plant?
Well, Elevate Plus and Novastar are amino acids. So the Elevate Plus, it's slow-release nitrogen, it's potassium, it's sulfur, and a whole array of micros, boron, manganese, zinc. And then, obviously, the Novastar is the polypeptide amino acid. It's going to help plant stress. It's just going to help improve that overall system inside that corn plant. Those two products together have done really, really well in all of our yield trials the last 2 years.
What about like a Recess Novastar type combination too?
Absolutely. I mean, you can run obviously Recess and or Red Shield, right? Again, once we get that potassium, you know, type technology that we have in those products, it's just going to help, you know, drive plant health and drive yield.
That's good. Well, guys, another great segment for our listeners. Excited to bring a couple more yet this growing season because we're not giving up on that crop. We want to maximize our yield potential. So if listeners want to reach out to you guys, how do they do that, Ryan?
Look us up on Facebook, Twitter, redstarany.com or redstarbranded.com.
That's right. Well, stay tuned. We'll be back next week.
All right. We finished that up, Delaney. It's time for your second story. You think you can handle it?
I hope so. So it's well known that soil health practices such as no-till and cover crops can benefit the environment and farmer's pocket, but can it make farmland more valuable at sale time? It's a question several different institutions are grappling with, including one Midwestern nonprofit and Cornell University. The Delta Institute has launched a pilot project to test the method for land appraisers to assign an accurate value to farmland that has various soil health practices installed. Meanwhile, Cornell University is conducting complementary work that examines both economic and policy incentives that would encourage farmers to steward long-term soil health practices, which I think is pretty neat. The Institute has also launched a pilot program in two states, Illinois and Michigan, testing out an alternative way for appraisers to account for soil health practices and setting those land values. The goal is to optimize a system for appraisers that can be accessible, useful, and fair. As well at Cornell, researchers are looking at how soil health affects farmland prices, as well as how farmland owners can better advertise their land soil's health upon sale and possible policy solutions. Seems like a pretty cool project.
That's impressive, the work that they can do. And I know there's been a lot of advancements in technology, especially when we talk on Farm for Profit. But what we saw this week tucked into the horticulture section of the Farm Bill approved by the House Ag Committee is language that is shielding the seed and ag chemical giant Bayer from lawsuits against its Roundup weed killer. Section 10204, running 1.5 pages, accounts to really a get-out-of-jail-free card. This is for pesticide companies, according to the avowed guardian of victims' rights. The provision to require uniformity in the national pesticide labeling would block states from writing their own warning labels for pesticides and says courts could not hold manufacturers liable for damages if they put only EPA-approved labels on their packages. The EPA says that glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, is safe to use. Section 10204, drafted with the aid of Bayer, according to the Washington Post, is including that language. A Bayer spokesperson said that glyphosate is safe, and the provision was not a shield at all. This is going to have to play out in the courts. Besides working in Washington, Bayer has pursued shield legislation unsuccessfully in Iowa, Missouri, and Idaho, according to this report. The state legislators this spring did dismiss those, Delaney. So quite interesting to see that, trying to get almost sneakily into that bill.
Oh, for sure. Sneaky, sneaky. But Tuesday of this week, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Negg provided an update on the highly pathogenic avian influenza state response measures, including announcing new testing requirements for the dairy cattle participating in Iowa fairs. He also reiterated his request to the USDA for resources for impacted farmers and extended his appreciation to Iowa farmers for the cooperation with testing and research efforts that are increasing the broader understanding of this virus. Following the June 7th announcement of the additional HPAI response measures in Iowa, including the required testing of dairy herds within a 20-kilometer radius around affected poultry farms, the quantity of tests has been ramping up. Additionally, farmers outside of the testing radiuses have also been submitting tests for their herds. As well, on June 7th, Secretary Negg made requests to the USDA to support impacted dairy and poultry farmers. Conversations are continuing, but as of June 25th, the USDA has not made any final decisions regarding Secretary Negg's request. These requests included compensation for cold dairy cattle at fair market value, compensation for lost milk production at a 90% minimum of fair market value, revisions to poultry indemnity tables to better reflect the fair market value of impacted birds and or eggs, and of course a streamlined and timely process for farmers to be compensated for lost production and to receive indemnity.
That was a story full of everything, but what I caught out of there is it was 20 kilometers, not 20 miles.
Yeah, kilometers. I got to keep that in mind.
That's right. Well, we do have the USDA's June acreage report that tends to be a major market mover coming out this week. Ahead of the June 28th report, ag economists were asked to weigh in on where they thought these acreage numbers could land. The majority of economists think that we could see more soybean acres than what was revealed in the March prospective plantings report, but they don't expect the corn acreage estimate to grow very much. I think that if we get growth in both corn and soybean planted acres, it will be negative for the markets. At least they'll respond negatively in the short run, said Brown. Some ag economists are saying that we will see less acres for both corn and soybeans. Of course, if that happens, we could get a surprise on the other side as well. I keep saying I think we've planted more acres, but we'll see what happens on the yield side. All of this could continue to pressure the prices and push them lower as we get closer to fall harvest, said Brown. Another wild card, Delaney, that we're dealing with is what happens to the principal crops number in March, one of the big surprises was a drop in overall acres this year. The USDA's report showed principal crop acres fell 6.3 million acres year over year. Again, when asking economists to weigh in on where they think those 6 million acres could go, more than half said they could go to corn acres. Some economists think those 6 million acres could shift to soybean, cotton, or wheat. So it sounds like not very many know at all what this report's going to have. So likely the USDA could show more hay acres, but let's kick it over to our conversation now with area agronomist Megan Anderson to learn more about what we're seeing in the fields right here in our backyard.
Well, we're super excited today to have Megan Anderson on with us today, an extension field specialist for Iowa State Extension. Megan, you are pretty famous on X, so we're excited to have you on and talk about all the things you're seeing in the fields. Good friend of the podcast, but welcome back to the new video show.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks for having me again.
So Megan, as we look at this growing season, obviously, especially here in central Iowa, growers had quite a few challenges getting the crop in the ground with a pretty wet planting season. As you think about planting season now in the rearview mirror, what are a couple of things you're thinking about as we reflect on maybe how to do it differently or better for next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things, right? We sort of ended up with two planting periods, right? That kind of like early to maybe the 22nd, 23rd or so of April, and then like mid-May through the end of May. So we've got a pretty distinct difference in our planting dates this year, which we haven't seen for several years. But one thing I've heard from a lot of farmers is that they, you know, started with soybeans because that's kind of the cool new thing, right? We've had several fairly cool springs, and soybeans can be pretty tolerant of that as compared to corn, where we want that really even emergence. And I've heard from a number of farmers who've said that they wish they would have started with corn this year instead of soybean because the forecast was so nice. And what happened for a lot of people was they ended up getting most or all of their soybeans in the ground in that early April timeframe, and they were trying to squeeze corn in right ahead of that cool period, and that didn't work out very well for them, or it ended up with them planting corn in May. And so I think that's something that people are going to remember as we move forward to future years. And I think that we're going to have that kind of stark reminder of what excess moisture can do to our crop in Iowa when we've got it, because we haven't had that for several years, but we definitely got it this spring.
Yeah, we've had several listeners talk to us and send us pictures on social media acknowledging that they've got ponds in places they didn't remember ponding because of that excess moisture.
Yeah, we've seen that a lot. And then something else that I have seen, which I'm you know, a little disappointed about, is I've seen some waterways, right, and other sort of buffer strip areas that have come out of those. And I think people were reminded, unfortunately, of that those are places that there's a lot of water that moves, right? And they serve a purpose in their fields. And we really haven't seen that for several years, but we definitely saw it this spring.
So as you mentioned, kind of those two different planting windows and folks trying to cram crop in before a rain came, how was emergence?
Emergence was honestly quite a bit better than I expected it to be. My stand counts have really been pretty good, at least on the corn side. I think on the soybean side, we did get burned some by some of those pounding rains and some of the crusting that has occurred in fields. I know some people dealt with it in corn, but not nearly as much as I expected. But I am hearing a lot about that in soybean, that we just had really prolonged emergence periods and then had issues where, you know, the soybeans just were unable to emerge because of that really thick crust at the soil surface.
You know, you mentioned earlier, maybe some growers started with soybeans this year and maybe wished they had started with corn instead. And I think that's always the gamble that farmers make. I know my husband is always debating, like, do I try and squeeze it in and get it in before this rainfall, or do I wait? You know, we had those two windows, like you mentioned. Looking back now at this year, what would have been maybe the ideal situation? Should growers have picked corn and done it early in April, or waited until maybe that May planting period?
Yeah, I think it really depends, honestly, from a field-to-field decision, because in some cases, I think that early April timeframe was absolutely perfect, right? We had a beautiful warm forecast afterward. We had warm soil temperatures, really great conditions to get corn off to a good start. And if there was a risk of freeze, right, corn was going to be much more tolerant. Obviously, we didn't get that this year. But the risk, of course, with that is that there were a lot of people that put their corn in early, and at least in my area, you know, a good portion of it was underwater after that because of how much rain we got. Whereas there are some folks that waited until that May timeframe and at least were able to get that corn in the ground evenly and not get those ponds. And so I think it maybe depends on how big the ponds are likely to get in a field and what the landscape position is as to what the best decision was. But I think people who got their corn in early in April are fairly pleased overall with it, even if they had to go do a little bit of replant.
I know in our area, there's a lot of discussion around side dressing. Some folks that hadn't planned on it are thinking about it. And those that did plan to side dress this year are increasing their rates. What are you seeing?
I'm hearing the same thing, right? We got a lot more rainfall than we've seen in quite a while. I mean, honestly, I think 2013 was the last year we had anything on the order of the rainfall that we got this spring. And honestly, in my area, from the south of one county to the north of another county, right, maybe 60, 70 mile difference, I've got a 9-inch or more rainfall difference. Wow. Between those two areas. And so there are absolutely some areas where we've likely lost a substantial amount of nitrogen if it was all applied, like, say, last fall, where we went into this really mild winter. We warmed up in February, and then we ended up getting all that moisture in April. And so I think there's a lot more discussion about the do we, don't we need more nitrogen? How do we get it on? More so than I've heard in a long time.
Megan, as we look then on the other side of the coin, we're talking maybe what crop protection we need to look at this year, considering that wet season, excess moisture. What kind of risks do we run here for disease?
Obviously, we have already found tar spot in a few counties that I serve here in central Iowa. And so that's pretty concerning, right? The earliest find that we have ever had in Iowa at all. But we don't really know what that means moving forward, right? Obviously, the inoculum is there. It has infected the plant, but really it's what the weather does going forward as to what the risk is going to be for our corn for pretty much any of the foliar diseases. And so as I think about the risk for something like tar spot or any other foliar disease, I'm thinking about how susceptible my hybrid is to that, or in soybeans case, how susceptible my variety might be to something like frog eye leaf spot. Right, what the weather is going to be like moving forward, and that's always a big risk, and then whether or not that's been an issue in the past. And another thing that I'm going to be thinking about is, oh, maybe what our apps or some of the resources that we have available to us can tell us, right? So we do have this Tar Spotter app available that can kind of analyze the weather and basically give you a risk factor as to what the risk is that you have tar spot out in your field. And those can be really good indicators to hone in when we need to be scouting our fields, not necessarily like, oh, I have high risk, I should go spray right now, but I have high risk, I need to be looking for this out in the field. And if we catch it early, we can watch these diseases develop over time, right? You don't go from one lesion on a leaf, five leaves below the ear to 100% leaf coverage, right? You know, your crop's dead in a week's time. It does take time for these to build up, and we have a really good opportunity finding them that early and that minor of injury so far to be able to watch them and truly make a really good decision as far as the timing of pulling the trigger on a fungicide if we need to.
Sounds like maybe a year to definitely do a little extra crop scouting to help with some of that prevention.
Yeah, that's been difficult. You walk around with a lot of mud on your boots trying to get out there. But Megan, what about also looking at weed pressure? Are we experiencing a different intensity this year because of the weather?
I think we got a lot more early emergence, which we expected because we were warm early from our weeds. And honestly, the weather, I think, has for the most part helped us aside from the wind, right? The wind and the rain have been really challenging to get in fields in a timely manner. But I think our cuticles are on our weeds are not as thick as they've been in prior years. I think they were probably easier to kill this year as long as we could get in those fields in a timely manner. I think one of the challenges is a lot of our timely post applications came without a really good rainfall after them. So if we included those residuals, which is always our recommendation, as we're waiting for our crop to canopy and we know that water hemp can emerge really late, I think we did have some residuals where we had weeds slip by, right? So maybe we got really good control of the stuff that was emerged, but we probably have some weeds out in the field because we really didn't get a great rainfall on a lot of that until just the last couple days. And so scouting fields, right, knowing what your weed pressures are like, knowing whether there's anything you can do yet this season to manage those weeds is really important. But I think, honestly, overall, we're in a little bit better shape maybe than we have been the past couple of years.
So, Megan, as we look beyond this harvest growing season, I want to circle back around to the nitrogen question. Do you think with that nitrogen loss that we saw this year, we're going to see growers do things differently when it comes to fall field work?
Oh, man, I can't predict the future. And so I don't know whether farmers are going to remember that, right? Because it's always that game of, you know, if they have time available this fall, right? If we get harvest done in a timely manner, fall field work is very likely to happen. But I think we may see some people saying, you know, look, I'm not going to put all my eggs in one basket. I'm not going to put this, you know, all my nitrogen on as anhydrous up front. Maybe I'm going to put a little bit more on with some type of spring applied application so that I sort of hedge my risk. Just in case we have another unseasonably warm winter that maybe puts that nitrogen at more risk like it did this last year.
So, Megan, as our listeners are taking all of this information in, what else do they need to be concerned about or should they be paying attention to?
Great question, right? Insect pressure has been a little bit higher this year. And so something that I'm thinking about right now in corn is what our corn rootworm pressure looks like. So in particular, folks that are continuous corn have been corn for especially 3 or more years in a field, I would be watching those fields very closely for corn rootworm pressure. And at least in Iowa, we should have larvae feeding on the roots right now, and it won't be too long and we'll start to see beetles emerging. And once those beetles start emerging, that's a really good time to evaluate the amount of root damage that you have. Oftentimes, our corn hybrids are really good in that they don't necessarily go down, right? That always used to be such a good sign. It's like, well, the corn's flat on the ground. I guess I'm going to dig the roots and we'll find the corn rootworm injury. But in some cases, we've got hybrids that are so good at recovering from this that we don't necessarily see them go flat with the wind in the middle of the summer. So going out and digging those roots, looking for those beetles, trying to catch that and understand what that pressure means moving forward and whether you need to make a change in management, I think is something big that people ought to be doing this year.
Well, Megan, we certainly appreciate your time joining us on the podcast. If any of our listeners and watchers want to connect with you or follow along with some of the things you're sharing this growing season, what's the best place to go to do so?
Well, I am on X, or former Twitter, that's at MJAnders1. And then you can also catch up with us on our crops.extension.iastate.edu webpage. We regularly post blogs and news articles there, and you can also subscribe to that on that website.
Fantastic, Megan. Well, thanks again for joining us today. Certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tanner, do you have any market commentary for us this week?
Well, we just have seen grains on another downward day with a massive fund selling that's been happening this week. We've got new lows that have moved in and scored across the complex. Don Roos of U.S. Commodities said that funds have been selling due to bearish technical signals, but we can't forget about the report that comes out on Friday. We also are seeing lower seasonals, and they are near record short for this time of year in the grain complex. When you're in new lows, that has no sign of a positive market outlook on corn and soybeans. He says the next area of chart support is November soybeans at $11, and according to Roos, $4.40 is the next level of support for December corn. He says traders continue to take out weather premium despite lower crop ratings and flooding in the northwestern corn belt, which we talked about. The problem, he states, is that the crop ratings started out at such a high level to begin with. Funds are also leaning bearish heading into this USDA report and quarterly stocks report that comes out on Friday, which we are recording ahead of, just so our listeners know. They're expecting a higher carryover than a year ago. But if you'd like full commentary on the report, tune in to the Monday release of the Farm for Profit podcast to hear from Andrew Caves of Lighthouse Commodities. But how do you think your first day on the podcast went, Delaney?
I think it went smoothly.
I thought you did a great job. And again, I don't think we need the old Delaney back, but we're not going to tell her that.
Sounds good.
Well, I'd say it's time to let the listeners go. What do you say?
Let's let them go.